You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
One important impetus for the creation of international law was World War II. This was a war that ravaged countries around the globe and ended in the death of an estimated 60 to 80 million people. From that human disaster, a vision rose, though not for the first time, of a world without war. With war and other crimes inseparable from this cruel pursuit, circumscribed by legal prohibitions and restraints. Still today, the savagery of war continues. We're joined by Michael Mandel to explore the promise and the failures of international law. Michael is a professor at Osgoode Hall Law School. He's an author and an activist. And we welcome you to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, Michael.
Thank you, Mordecai.
Let's begin with the promise, the vision of a world without war. What was created in terms of international law and institutions in the aftermath of World War II?
Well, it's quite extraordinary, actually, because, I think that the impetus for this came out of the First World War and the radicalizing experience, this horrible conflagration. You know, after the First World War, there was a radicalization of working people all over the world, and we had the revolutions, and we had the counter-revolutions, and we had fascism, and some people call the Second World War just, they call the First and Second World War just the One World War. So after that, a quite extraordinary thing happened, and I often think of that song, last night I had the strangest dream, and Canadian songwriter wrote it. And they put this charter of the United Nations together, which essentially banned war. And it made war illegal. And it attempted to put principles into place, and institutions into place, that would guarantee its illegality, and most importantly, guarantee the independence, equality of peoples, and the self-determination of peoples. And all this was written into the Charter of the United Nations, which started out, we the people of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. And so they essentially banned war, and they put in place democratic institutions to ensure that if war was carried out, it would be carried out only in the common interest and only with the consent of the world, and would basically be to prevent war, that war would only be authorized by these democratic institutions to prevent war. And that was the most important institution, was the Security Council, which was elected, for the most part by the General Assembly, where every nation in the world was equal and had one vote. And of course, there were the five victors of World War II that would have a permanent veto. The United States, Russia, China, Great Britain, and France would have these vetoes. But essentially, the veto was a negative thing, so that war could not be authorized unless you got a majority of the Security Council. And the veto meant that war could not happen if one of those big powers was against it. So it was pretty much a peace document, and quite inspiring. And I think it answered the need of people for great need for peace and democracy and justice.
There was a provision as well for the creation of a court. Maybe it's probably less well known than the United Nations itself. Could you explain that court?
That was the International Court of Justice, which was an organ, a very important organ of the United Nations for the peaceful settlement of disputes. That was the main aim of the Charter of the United Nations. And this was a court, and it still is a court, it's the International Court, some people call it the World Court, where, a court that is elected by the General Assembly and the Security Council, no vetoes, to determine disputes. Now, because it's an international court, it's consensual. In other words, there has to be an agreement to its jurisdiction, but there's a broad agreement to its jurisdiction. And famously, the United States had agreed to its jurisdiction before it was condemned in the Nicaragua case for aggression against Nicaragua, a very important case. And then the United States decided it wasn't so happy with the World Court anymore, and it pulled out and would only consent on a case-by-case basis, which it sometimes does. So the World Court, the Security Council, the General Assembly, these very inspiring institutions that were meant to really realize all the frustrations that people had felt in the first half of the 20th century.
Now, you mentioned that the United Nations was an institution committed to the eliminating the scourge of war. It doesn't totally eliminate the right of a country to engage in a war, but it does specify very limited circumstances in which that is possible. Could you explain what those circumstances are?
Well, the number one one, the main one, is the Security Council, by majority, and now it takes 9 members, to agree that the use of force is absolutely necessary in the interest of international peace and security. So that if the United Nations authorizes a war, that's the main one under the Charter of the United Nations. So you have to get not only the powers that are engaged in the war, but a majority of this elected body, the Security Council, to go along with it. And, you know, a good example is the war in Iraq, where the Americans wanted to go to war against Iraq for the usual reasons of greed and imperialism, and they had to convince the Security Council, and they didn't convince the Security Council. So the war, that's why the war against Iraq, with the terrible cost in human life, 1 million Iraqis killed and how many injured and lives destroyed, that war was certified illegal because they could only get 4 votes out of 15 in the Security Council for war. So although, obviously, the fact that it was illegal didn't mean that the people who deserved to be punished for it, the Bushes and the Rumsfeld and the Colin Powells and the Condoleezza Rices, ever went to trial for it. But on the other hand, we know that war was a war of aggression, and that war was just a case of mass murder because it didn't have the consent of the Security Council. So that's the main one. The other one is self-defense. And, the United States has unfurled self-defense, and Canada's gone along with them often, especially in the case of Afghanistan and all these killings in Pakistan, these drones. Obama administration continues the Bush doctrine that they have the right to use force in self-defense. And that is a limited exception under the Charter of the United Nations. It's a limited exception until the Security Council has an opportunity to take the necessary measures. So, this is a case where somebody's under attack. They're allowed to defend themselves until the Security Council can intervene. But the United States has abused this enormously because the Security Council has had plenty of time to intervene, and they've stretched this doctrine of self-defense to the case that where anybody raises an eyebrow against them, their interest, they claim the right to self-defense. And, most lawyers think it's bogus. But it's a right that is very seriously abused. But obviously, if a country is attacked and it has no choice but to defend itself and it has no time for the Security Council to intervene, this is the limited exception. It's the kind of thing that really allows, for instance, in Gaza, without for Gaza to respond to Israeli attacks, Israeli aggressions, that sort of thing. But again, it's abused, and the lack of an international court enforcement mechanism makes these things liable to abuse. But I think the important thing about the Charter of the United Nations, like a lot of law, it's not its enforcement mechanism, but it's the standard by which people can judge and criticize and oppose these kinds of actions. I don't know if you remember. I remember very, very well as a lawyer in the demonstrations against the war in Iraq. This war is illegal. And they were right, and people who didn't study law but knew and were well informed were convinced that it was an illegal war. And the slogans at that time were "From Iraq to Palestine, occupation is a crime," and they were correct as well. So this legal, international legality resonates, I think, very strongly with people, and I think it's an important criterion. The Charter of the United Nations responds to the aspirations of the world for equality and for peace and for justice. Obviously, the big powers are constrained by it. They don't like it. The Americans have been trying to undermine the United Nations and international law for a long time. And because obviously the powerful countries would rather there be no law, but most people in the world, our interests are served by there being law and there being this Charter of the United Nations, which is, it's not only a question of legality and anti-peace, it's very democratic. It treats people as equals, and that's extremely important, and the big powers don't like that. And I think that's the impulse of the 20th century that came out of the First World War, the Union Movement, the movement for suffrage, the anti-imperialist revolutions, and that's what the Charter of the United Nations represents. And you know, the question of the fact that we can enforce it, we don't seem to be able to enforce it against these big powers, but they seem to be able to enforce it against the usual suspects. I don't think that should deter us from using it as an instrument. I mean, look at, I don't want to go on and on, but the Charter of the United Nations is binding international law because it's a treaty. All international law is treaty, and that's the idea of a voluntary promise being binding. So the United States, you know, and every state in the world has signed that charter, and the United States, if it doesn't like the Charter of the United Nations, can withdraw from it. But it hasn't, because obviously it would, you know, it likes to claim that it's a law-abiding partner. But anyway, it's just a question of being bound by one's promises among equals. And that's the big appeal of the Charter of the United Nations and international law, that it's there by consent. And consequently, I think that's, you know, one of its great appealing factors.
Another tactic, though, of imperial powers, and it's been used in the war in Libya and so on, is to justify war on what are called, quote unquote, humanitarian grounds, the urgency and the responsibility to protect. And Canada was very prominent in pushing this as another rationale for war in the Security Council.
Well, this is the third ground. It's the idea of the responsibility for protect and humanitarian intervention is that the people who advocate them as an independent ground beyond Security Council authorization and beyond self-defense. And, you know, the Americans have been pushing that for a long time. Look at, but the Charter of the United Nations is against it. I say look at because Hitler justified the Second World War against Poland as a humanitarian intervention on behalf of German minorities in Poland. And that's when it all started. So the Charter was very clear in forbidding that kind of thing, that you're not allowed to bomb a people for its own good. And war being the problem, not the solution. And you know, the United States tried to advocate, and a lot of the apologists for American warmongering tried to advocate this as another exception. And it was used in the Kosovo War. And Canadians, you know, Lloyd Axworthy and all those advocates of it, and Michael Ignatieff, I might say, very prominently, tried to get this humanitarian intervention recognized as an exception. But the rest of the world just wasn't buying it. And, you know, a massive number of countries said, we reject this because it's just a disguise for might makes right, because who needs a humanitarian intervention any more than the United States, with 2 million of its own people in jail on any given day and this incredible inequality and violence in the United States. But it's a right that only the big powers could use, and that's been recognized for a long time. On the other hand, the notion of the Security Council collectively authorizing it, that's been accepted for a long time. And it was used recently in Libya. That's the distinction between Kosovo and Libya. Kosovo, the consent of the Security Council could not be got. You couldn't convince a majority of the Security Council that this was a legitimate war, and consequently it was illegal. But in Libya, the Americans and the French and the British were able to convince or cow the rest of the Security Council into authorizing this intervention, a very limited intervention in Libya, a humanitarian intervention. And, you know, the Russians and the Chinese and even the Germans and the Indians said they were opposed to it, but they didn't veto it. They didn't vote against it. They just abstained. And quite, you know, cowardly in my view, because what was at stake. But of course, they were intimidated by the media and this massive propaganda machine. And they authorized this limited intervention to protect civilians in Libya. But of course, the NATO countries and the United States just laughed at these limits and went way beyond them to regime change, which they'd planned all the time. And I think it was pretty obvious that was what was going to happen. And consequently, the very careful limits of that resolution, 1973 of 2011, were completely ignored, and that made that war as well an illegal war, an aggressive war, because it was not guided at protecting civilians. I mean, at the end of the war, they were bombing cities to overthrow the last bits of resistance, let alone protect civilian areas. They were bombing them. And, you know, I think that, you know, the Security Council, it's not foolproof, but I think it's, you know, we wouldn't want to delegitimate the Security Council because it is a negative right. You know, it's, you can't go to war unless you have the approval, and the alternative is to be able to go to war without even getting anybody's approval, without having it judged at all. So Libya was an abuse of this, and abuse of this right, and probably, you know, I think, you know, an overturning of this right. It wouldn't, you know, in a court of law, what they did in Libya could not possibly be said to be consistent with that that Security Council resolution. In the Libyan conflict, the role of the International Criminal Court was, you know, it's a court, and you think, well, it's, you know, it's international law, but this kind of institution, you know, basically set up by the Yugoslavian tribunal was set up by the big powers. The International Criminal Court is beholden to the big powers, even though they stay out of it. This is a different kind of idea. There, what's happening is the legitimation of an aggressive war by the indictment, the demonization of the enemies of the big powers. And so what happened was that the International Criminal Court, having been referred this case by the Security Council, immediately jumped to attention and started to brand Gaddafi on really bogus evidence as war criminals. And without even waiting for a trial, just like in the Milosevic case, this encouraged the big powers to justify a bombing campaign. So it's quite the opposite of what the Charter of the United Nations was meant to do, which is to prevent war. These institutions seem to be meant to justify war. And of course, they only prosecute the enemies of the big powers, so that the only people on trial before the International Criminal Court are African countries who have been the enemies of the big powers. So we have to be very, you know, it's no accident that these courts are located in The Hague, where the International Court of Justice is located, and it's not because of the excellent herring they have in The Hague, but it's really to confuse people into thinking that these are equivalent institutions, and they're not.
Well, I have to leave it at that, Michael. Thank you
Mordecai,
very much.
Mordecai, I talked a lot, and I'm very sorry for your listeners.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thanks, Mordecai.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I've been speaking with Michael Mandel. He's a professor at Osgoode Hall Law School and an activist. He's author of the book, How America Gets Away with Murder, Illegal Wars, Collateral Damage, and Crimes Against Humanity.